BFFT. Now, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, this is a special Big Ten Media Week edition of The Bald-Faced Truth.
Final day of the week of this epic week from Big Ten Media Days in Indianapolis and our coverage here on the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Network, 750 The Game in Portland and wherever you may be listening. Thanks for making it part of your day, part of your week. It's been so much fun. So many interviews along the way, including an epic day of radio yesterday, Thursday, with John Canzano in Indianapolis, Dylan Gabriel, Jeffrey Bassa, Terrence Ferguson, Dan Lanning. Oh, yeah. Caught up with Jonathan Smith in the tunnel as well. That was just fascinating audio to hear from. Want to touch on some of John's takeaways in the week in review and a little bit of everything with John as well here on the BFT after just a flurry of really exciting interviews from the week in Indianapolis. So let's go ahead and pop them on. John Canzano joining us. John, have you touched down in Portland now?
I am in the great state of Oregon. I'm happy to be back in the great state of Oregon. I have to say that, you know, I've talked about my time covering the Big Ten years ago. I didn't like the cold. I didn't particularly find the Midwestern food or, frankly, the people all that interesting. So I had vowed when I left there, Judah, that I was never going back. And lo and behold, there I was in Indianapolis seeing a lot of familiar faces from even 25 years ago when I was on that beat at IU. There was a couple of media members that were still there. They looked older. I think I looked the same, but it was surreal to see the Oregon, Washington, USC, UCLA contingents mixing in there. And I'm sure when the football starts, it'll feel a little more normalized.
What does that tell you about the Big Ten culture out there? The fact that there's, you know, a decent amount of media that's been covered. I'm sure that's the case in a lot of regions in the country, but the Midwest does feel different.
Can we have a talk about people for a second here? And I'm not going to single out any media member or anybody in our audience who's listening, but I kind of feel like I said this because I looked around and I saw some people who, you know, were up there in age who are still covering those beats. And Judah, I'm not going to be that guy at 75 years old who's in the press box. I'm not. And I always wonder when I see that guy, I wonder, you know, I go, you know, do they need something more in their life? You cannot be that married to your job and your beat and your identity being wrapped up in covering a sports team. And I don't know, maybe there are people out there that, and they're in their own jobs and they'll look over and go, hey man, I'm out at 64 or I'm out at 62 or whatever age people are retiring in their industry. But I always kind of wonder, and I kind of feel the same way about these Ironman triathletes. I always kind of wonder, what else is going on in your life? Do you need more? You know, why are you running a marathon and biking 112 miles? Like, you know, don't you have something you need to be doing besides that? But that's a conversation probably for another day.
Well, maybe that's your next step in your career when you're ready to be done. You could start like a rehab program for sports journalists, sports radio hosts. Here's your next step to find identity.
Yes, your next step, your identity, but your identity shouldn't be your job. Like, we talk about that all the time. You have, you know, a wife and a beautiful daughter, and you have family, and you know that, you know, this is your job, and you do it. This is my job, and I do it. But you better have something else going on, or, you know, when you look up at retirement age, you're not going to want to go.
That's right. That's exactly right, and that's a great reminder. Sometimes that bleeds into sports a little bit. You know, I don't know how much Olympic coverage you've been able to see yet because you've been flying back home, but even when the Olympics come on, I see a little bit of that coverage, and you get more of that, you know, global feel of the impact of sports, and obviously we're geared up for college football, the NFL, et cetera, but you've been to Olympic Games. You've had some epic interviews with Olympians in the past. Like Rulon Gardner's one of my favorites because that happened when I was a little kid at the Sydney Games in 2000, and like you've had him on the show, and that kind of, you know, connects with you on a like a personal level, on a lifestyle level in a different way. Like the Olympics has the ability to do that, and it kind of snuck up on me this year, I'll be honest.
Yeah, I've covered 5 Olympics, and I always tell people there's nothing like it. And, you know, I was in Sydney in 2000, Athens in 2004, Beijing in 2008, London in 2012. I did the Vancouver Winter Games. I don't think the Winter Olympics holds the same punching power that the Summer Games does, but it's still interesting to see, you know, there's so much of what we talk about and root for is, you know, American-centric. Even the Olympics, as they're presented on NBC, there's a little bit of America, pro-America propaganda going on there. So it's I always find it interesting to kind of step outside of that and look at some of the other coverage that's going on nationally. And, you know, are they emphasizing the same things? But to actually be at the games is it's a remarkable experience. And it's phenomenal to see this culminating moment in someone's life. And Rulon Gardner wrestling Alexander Caroline, the Russian bear, and Michael Phelps swimming in the pool, and Usain Bolt running, and Simone Biles on the beam, and there's great, great things that are happening. Now, I happen to think that this Paris Games is a very important Olympics because I think we're at a really interesting pivot point with broadcast rights, and, you know, you see what's going on with the NBA, college football went through its thing. I think it's really important that these Paris Games deliver in a way that television says, oh, we have to continue to cover this and invest in this because there's only so many dollars in the ecosystem in that media world. And so I really kind of wonder, where is this TV money that has been invested recently in the NBA and college football? Does it threaten the Olympic Games, or will the Olympics continue to kind of, you know, every 4 years become a really special thing that we all see on television? So I also think that the Pac-12, the downfall of the Pac-12, all those Olympians that won gold medals and silver and bronze in the last Olympics, it was more than 100 medals, I believe, by 90 athletes. You know, will our country continue without the Pac-12 to create these great Olympic development programs? Will the Big Ten be as impactful in that way, or are we going to take a step back because of the Pac-12's downfall?
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought of that. It also makes me wonder, are we going to be ready to host the thing in 4 years from now?
No, the answer is no. They're never ready. In Athens in 2004, I'll never forget, it was the day of the opening ceremony, and they were painting the stadium. They weren't ready. And there's always little things like that. But the Greeks, you know how they are. They were like, we got it. We got it. We'll be ready.
Yeah.
You know, the paint was still wet inside the stadium. So there's going to be stuff like that. I do think it'll be a little different Olympics in the United States because, you know, in those international things, it's really cool to walk into the venues and to see the flags of like 30 different countries being waved at a single event. And I kind of wonder how spread out the LA games will be. You know, Athens, they were kind of all central to Athens, Beijing, same, London, the same, but we will see how LA does in its second go around.
John Cazzano's on the phone with us. I want to hit on a few things that I thought were really interesting from your conversations at Indianapolis, but you mentioned the fall of the Pac-12, and I can't help but think of what Dan Lanning told you in your interview with him. He was talking about, you know, and all the coaches are praising Tony Petitti. It's like something that's in their contracts. They have to say, great job by the commissioner, love his leadership, yada, yada. But Dan said that Tony, you know, he's not just a listener. He can put, you know, our input into action to make change. And I got flashbacks of George Kliavkov's listening tour and all the listening that George Kliavkov did and the lack of action that came with that listening, at least to me. Did that stand out to you at all, or is that just rhetoric? Or, you know, when you look back at George and compared to you've interacted now with Tony a little bit, how do you kind of compare the two styles?
Tony's a really different guy. He's not interested. You know, his background's in TV production. So he was the guy who was in the TV truck for, you know, football games on CBS on Sundays. And he produced a few Super Bowls, and then he kind of rose through the ranks. He's always been behind the scenes, but he's a New Yorker. I mean, he grew up in Queens. His dad was a police officer. His dad is tough. Tony is kind of no nonsense. Even people who work for him in the Big Ten offices say, you know, he's not going to be the kind of guy who's going to tell you you're doing a great job. If you don't hear from him, you're doing a good job. Like, you know, because he will get after you if you're not. And so, you know, he's in his early 60s. I wonder how long he will be in that role. Felt like he was kind of a stabilizing force. Interesting to see Kliavkov, Yormark, and Petitti all coming from the non-traditional world of, you know, media and marketing. Yormark was with Jay-Z's Rock Nation. Kliavkov was with MGM and Hulu. And Petitti, his background certainly in television and the Major League Baseball Network. These were not college administrators like Greg Sankey and Jim Phillips and Bob Delaney. This was a real deviation. And all three of those commissioners were hired by Turnkey, which is a search firm. And I kind of wondered, Judah, like, if you had shuffled them, and Yormark is the Pac-12's commissioner instead of the Big 12's, or Petitti's the Pac-12's, does it make a difference? Or was the die cast? Was L.A., that L.A. market, bound to leave anyway, was UCLA and USC? Or could something have been done? And I will forever wonder that as we look back on it. And I thought Petitti said something real interesting in the interview that, you know, we played yesterday on the show. It's the first time I've heard a commissioner say that the Big Ten's plan for the other sports really doesn't work. And he said there was work to do. And, you know, he talked about it. He said, we all know football's driving the decisions, but it's not ideal for these other sports. And so I still kind of wonder what's going to happen as football becomes more and more important, bigger investment in football, employees are made. I just still kind of wonder if we will see a separation like Chip Kelly wished for, you know, when this was all going down.
It does seem like there's more things to resolve, but there is excitement for the fall. What was your overall impression of Dan Lanning? Maybe not the things that he said, or maybe the things that he said, but his overall attitude, his vibe, his posture. You got to sit down and next to him, be in close quarters. What did you make of Dan this week?
Well, I thought on the stage he was the best of the 18 coaches that spoke. I mean, he spoke for 7 or 8 minutes. His opening statement was 7 or 8 minutes. Then he took questions. He's just super polished. He's confident. He's, you know, he looked like he was running for office up there, you know, and I think, you know, he would have got the nomination if there was a vote in the room. Like, everybody was really impressed. Like, all the Big Ten media were saying, gosh, this guy is great. But, you know, I think he's getting some training at Oregon that maybe UCLA is not giving to Sean Foster. Like, it's just evident that, you know, there were some talking points that Lanning brought to the thing, you know, including the line he gave us in the interview where he said, you know, if I'm looking at your ice cream cone, I'm not going to let mine melt in front of me while I'm doing that. You know, he said that to about 5 or 6 different reporters. I saw it tweeted. I saw it on the big stage. He obviously came with a few things he really wanted to get out there, and that was one of them. But he's smart that way, and I give him a lot of credit. And you know, he came up to me. I had not talked to him in a little while, and he had a busy summer. We had texted a little bit, and he came up to me and he said, hey, you know, we're always going to be good. You know, he told me that after the Washington game as well. I had criticized him for going for it on fourth down a little bit too much, being a gambler. And the next time I saw him, he said, hey, I want you to know, I get it. You have a job to do. We're always going to be good. And I always feel like that's the relationship I had with Chip Kelly. It's the relationship I've had with Jonathan Smith to some extent, Mike Riley. Dan Lanning, for a 38-year-old head coach, he's got thick skin. He knows what the game's about. And I'll say this. After talking to Rick Neuheisel, I had Oregon second in the Big Ten. And you know, I kind of looked at Ohio State and Oregon, and I gave the edge to Ohio State because of the coaching. But after I saw Lanning yesterday in doing his whole thing, I kind of wondered, like, I go, he might have better players than Ohio State, and he seems to have taken a step forward. And I love the way he answered the questions yesterday. And so it was the first time I thought, gosh, they've got Ohio State at home. Could they win this thing? And could they win it in year one? And is this the year? Is Dylan Gabriel the guy that's going to take them to a national championship? I don't think that that's a ridiculous question.
I'm glad you said that, because I'm right there with you. I don't want to be swayed by rhetoric or what I see at media days. But, you know, Dylan Gabriel, he is that X factor. Either He is a top two or three quarterback in the nation and maybe the best quarterback in the nation in this system with the skill level he has around him. Or we're asking too much of him to fill Bo Nix's shoes after 2 years, and we're underestimating what Bo Nix brought to the table. Dylan, I thought, knocked it out of the park this week at Indianapolis. I mean, he's oozing with confidence. He seems very polished, certainly experienced. Did your opinion of Dylan Gabriel change at all during the time that you got to know him?
Yeah, it did, and mainly because I was wondering about his size. Remember, we had talked about, you know, he looked small in the spring game. And he looks small behind Oregon's big offensive line. So the first thing I did was I sized him up. And he's bigger than I thought he was. You know, I was thinking, gosh, is he 5'10"? Is he 5'9"? Is he 5'11"? You know, how big is this guy? He looked like he was 6'1", 6'1 and a half, big enough. Then the other thing is, you know, I'm somebody, too, who I don't want to be swayed by, oh, they won the news conference. They're going to have a better season. Sometimes that doesn't pencil out. But the questions I have about Oregon are about leadership and maturity and growth with the coaching staff. And, hey, can Dylan Gabriel can he be a reasonable facsimile for Bo Nix? And I left yesterday going, gosh, Dan Lanning sounds more mature, more polished, like he's not worried about the things 2 years ago. He's worried about trying to figure out how to be a first-year head coach. He's much more settled down, much more in rhythm. And I think he has a quarterback whose energy and outlook matches the head coach. And nothing against Bo Nix, but if we're being real, Bo Nix was so polished. Much of what he was developed, I think, at Auburn. And, you know, he had his own people around him. It was almost Manchurian Candidate-like with Bo Nix. Like, you know, he knew what to say. I don't really ever feel like we really got to know Bo, because I think Bo knew, like, this is what I'm going to say, this is what I want people to think I'm about, and he would let you in a little bit, but not all the way. I felt like Dylan Gabriel in our interview, he's got that same moxie that Dan Lanning has. And you know, you ever talk to somebody and as you're talking to them, they look away all the time? Or I've done this in interviews where you're interviewing an athlete and they're looking away, or they're looking at their phone, or they're not interested. Dylan Gabriel gets in a staring contest with you when you're interviewing him. Like, he is eyes on your eyes, turned towards you. He is there to absorb what you're saying, listen to what you're saying, and answer it. And I think that counts, because if he's giving me that, he owes me nothing. If he's giving me that, I know what he's given his coaches and his teammates. And I was just really impressed with him. And you know, again, it doesn't make you a better player. I can remember on media day not being very impressed with Shedeur Sanders. You know, some of that came to fruition. Some of that came true. Where late in the year, we kind of saw through Shedeur, and he's got all kinds of talent, but he was disinterested and not engaged. Dylan Gabriel was locked in, and I kind of think he's going to have a really big year. And physically, I think he's going to be more of a running threat than Bo Nix was, and I think he's got some moxie to him.
No question. John Canzano is joining us on the show. We talked a little bit about your one-on-one with Jonathan Smith yesterday, and you offered some of your commentary on it. It aired on the radio side yesterday as well. Now, a couple days removed from that, any other thoughts kind of looming around in your brain as it relates to Jonathan Smith, his exit, and his perspective on how things ended at Oregon State?
Yeah, I had thought about it a lot. It crosses my mind, you know, as I'm going through TSA or, you know, checking out of my hotel. I was kind of thinking about him, and I was thinking about how awkward he is. And I don't mean this as a knock on him. He just, in general, is kind of an awkward guy. Even when he would do his news conferences at Oregon State, he was clunky, and he was awkward, and the interactions you'd have with him were a little awkward. And a lot of that came up, you know, on Wednesday as he addressed the issue and we were talking in the hallway. But he was in a little bit of disbelief about why Oregon State fans would be mad at him. And the more I think about it, the more I'm going, like, is his inner circle really not telling him, like, hey, you could have handled that better, you should have done better, Oregon State fans are mad, look at the, you know, 31-7 in that Civil War game, It was a waste of time for everybody who I felt like it wasted my time. I went and covered that game. You know, I drove down there. I drove through traffic. I invest the time to do my job. I don't think Oregon State's coaching staff did their job on that game. And I think, you know, Jonathan, I think, needs to own that. And I think he needs to understand why people are frustrated with him. That said, it's a business. I understand why he took the job. I think most of us understand why he took the job. I think most people in his position would have done the same thing. I just think Oregon State is a little different. It's different than other schools. It's different than other places. What they were going through last year was different. And I think Jonathan Smith needed to be more tuned into that. And so I don't think that's done. He said he thinks he's going to have to answer it come game week when they open that Big Ten season at Autzen Stadium. And I think I'm done with it. It closed the circle for me. I put it to rest. But I think there's still some Oregon State fans out there. If you read the comment section of my column about it at johncanzano.com, there's some Oregon State fans who aren't over it. Yeah. And I don't think they ever will be. And they will be rooting hard for Oregon in that game. As much as it might pain them, they're Duck fans that week.
You know, I think about Dennis Erickson's exit from there, and you've got, you know, you were right forefront to that when he was telling you, I'm not leaving, and he takes the Niner job.
He was mad at me.
It's hilarious.
Erickson told me, because I'd written the column, and I said, you know, Dennis Erickson's going to leave. That was the column. And, you know, this is 2002, December of 2002, and Erickson is pissed, and he's like, you know, come down to my office. I really want to hash this out with you. We need to have a good working relationship. And so I drive down there, and he argues, and he says, right when I walked in, he says, what did I do? Did I steal a girlfriend from you sometime, or what happened? And we argue about it. We end up fine at the end. I find that to be the case of most coaches that you have a disagreement with. If you could just hash it out, you can find some common ground. But and then he says, here's my number. Call me anytime you need me. And then, you know, he's San Francisco 49ers announced that he's their new coach like 48 hours later.
Oh, man. Hey, you say Chip, you guys had a good relationship eventually. It was bumpy, though, for a while, right?
In the middle, it got bumpy. It got bumpy around Willie Lyles because I felt like Chip, you know, I don't want to say he lied. I felt misled by Chip. And for me, trust is so important with sourcing and coaches. You know, it's not my job to protect their program. It's not my job to write happy things, and I'm not their PR arm. And I think most coaches get that. The ones who don't, I don't have, you know, good relationships with. And Chip, when he first arrived, he's got some East Coast in him. And I found it very refreshing that he wanted to think for himself. He had other coaches who had preceded him at Oregon saying, you know, don't deal with that guy. And Chip came up to me and he told me, he goes, my father told me to make my mind up for myself. And he said, I haven't found you to be unfair. I just think you're opinionated and sometimes people don't want to hear it. And we got along fine. We didn't always agree, but we got along fine. Even the times when he called in and we argued, we got along fine. We still do to this day. But the Willie Lyles thing, you know, I had asked him point blank, do you know Willie Lyles? He told me no. And then I requested the phone records at Oregon, and they had talked to each other like 22 times. Like, so it was like, you know, and Chip told me there was a reasonable explanation for it. He never gave it to me. But, you know, I forgive him for that. I think coaches sometimes have to be elusive and evasive when it benefits them and protect their program and their coaches. But that's where we had our breakdown. And, you know, we've since reconnected, and you know, many years ago when he came back to UCLA, he reached out, and I'm still in touch with him to this day. And I had people ask me at Big Ten Media Day. They said, you know, other reporters who do not have good relationships with him said, you know, they found him really difficult. And I said, it's probably because all you wanted to do was talk about football. Chip Kelly wants to talk about, you know, politics and movies, cereal. What he gets for Christmas from his mother, you know, he's just got views that are really outside the box. And I think we get along because I'm the same way. It would drive me crazy if all we wanted to talk about was football.
Well, and I know that he's coached at Autzen Stadium as a member of the opponent before with UCLA, but I'd be hard pressed to imagine an individual more motivated to win that football game October 12th than Chip Kelly calling plays in the press box. I mean, can you just picture that? Chip Kelly coaching against Oregon at the press box in Autzen, just like he was doing in 2007, 2008.
It's going to be really electric. And, you know, I think the big factor in that game is how does Dan Lanning and Tosh Lapoy on the defensive side, you know, those are the defensive minds that are going to be matched up against Ryan Day and Chip Kelly. So Dan Lanning and Tosh Lapoy, we need to see those guys early in the year before October 12th. We need to see growth and adjustment from those guys, because they are going to be in a chess match with, you know, a couple of grandmasters on the offensive side. That is two elite play callers in Ryan Day and Chip Kelly. And they're going to have all sorts of weapons at Ohio State. But keep an eye on the early part of the season for Oregon, you know, particularly that opener with Michigan State. Do we see Oregon adjusting, and do we see them better with in-game management than they've been in the past? Because if we don't, then, you know, that game against Ohio State could be really rough. But if we do, you know, how do you pick against Oregon? Rick Neuheisel said it. He said Oregon at home in that game, he's taking Oregon.
These are epic storylines. I mean, I remember when Mike Riley brought his Nebraska team into Autzen Stadium, and thinking about a former Beaver coach back on the Autzen sideline. Now, Jonathan Smith is going to have the same narrative with him in October. Chip Kelly is going to be calling plays for Ohio State in that building. I mean, we're in the Big Ten for Oregon. It's crazy stuff. Last thing for you, John. Our friend in Seattle, Softy, he had Kalen DeBoer call in this week. First interview that Kalen's done up there in Seattle since taking the job in Alabama. And it was pretty good. I mean, Softy did a good job. He asked some good pointed questions, but you know, one of them kind of underscores something similar to Jonathan Smith. The exit of these coaches from the places where they coached, it's been so bumpy and it seems so tone deaf sometimes. Like Softy was asking Kalen, why didn't you write a letter? Why didn't you post anything on social media to your fan base? You know, there seemed to be just a lack of empathy from you when you left. And, you know, he gave the coach speak. Are coaches ever going to get it, you think, that it's okay sometimes to take the next job, to take the next stepping stone, but how you leave matters? Are they ever going to get it?
No, I don't think they will. And, you know, it's really interesting because I think about it because, you know, on some level, I've got a professional relationship with these coaches. And I have found over the years, Judah, that the minute they don't need you, you're like the whole, you know, you're my buddy act goes away. And so I'm under no illusion with Dan Lanning or Trent Bray or any of these coaches that I have covered that these are my buddies. You know, I'm here to do a job. That it's different for fans, though, because as a fan, that's your guy. That's the guy that's in charge of the thing that you love so much. And we have been, I think, conditioned by the NFL to say, oh, it's a business in the NFL, but college athletics is different. But the truth is, there's less and less difference every day. The games are looking more and more like professional games. The coaches are behaving like NFL coaches who will leave and leave for a better job. And the truth is, I think you have to, you know, grow up a little bit. If you're a Washington fan, you better be well aware that, you know, Chris Peterson walked away. That didn't hurt as much. But, you know, Kalen DeBoer left you. Now Jed Fish is there. Jed Fish is not a forever guy at Washington. Look at his resume. Okay, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. Jed Fish is going to leave for a better job if he wins. So it ends with Jed Fish carrying a cardboard box out of the offices at Washington. Now, is he leaving because he's delivered them to the promised land like Kalen DeBoer did, or is he leaving because it didn't work out? I think if you're a Washington fan, if you had your druthers, you would say, okay, let's get back to the national title game. But it's just it's a reality of today's game. And I noticed this too. It's nothing I want to write about. I told, you know, Guy Haberman of the Big Ten Network and I were talking. He said, what were your takeaways? And I said, did you notice the athletes? Because there were about 50 athletes there from the 18 schools. They were dressed differently than they had been in the past. They acted a little differently. You know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of the NFL. They were wearing really nice clothes. They were very, aware, socially aware, brand aware. I remember Justin Herbert at Pac-12 Media Day several years ago in Los Angeles. He was wearing jeans and sneakers.
Yeah.
These guys were dressed to the nines. And, you know, you heard the interview with Jeff Bassa, you know, and I loved it. And I loved talking to him. But this was an advertisement for Louis Vuitton. Like, it was, these guys are wearing nicer threads and well aware of the opportunities that are out there in front of them. These are professional athletes now.
Bassa was phenomenal to listen to. I didn't know much about him, so to hear his interest in fashion design and everything going forward, I think was really, really cool.
I kind of have a bone to pick with him, if you don't mind me going a little further here.
Pick it.
But, you know, I called him Jeffrey at one point of the interview, and he kind of whispered to me, Jeff. And then after the interview, I said, did you go by Jeffrey at any point? Because in my head, I have you as Jeffrey. And he said, no. And then I looked on his Instagram, and it says Jeffrey Bassa. So I don't know if he's aware of that. He sent me a text last night thanking me for the interview. I'm going to text him back, say, hey, screenshot, your name's Jeffrey, not Jeff, or change your Instagram.
On the roster, he's Jeffrey. On all the, he's Jeffrey.
What's he talking about?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Man. That's a great question, because that's a weird thing to point out.
When you're Jeff.
Yeah. All right. Jeff Bassa. Because I've heard him called Jeff Bassa, but I didn't know that it was a preference, because everywhere else he's Jeffrey. So.
Right. I've seen Jeffrey everywhere. And I thought it was me, you know, and I thought, you know, because me, like, I can't control how good these guys are as interviews, and they were all great, but I always try to be the best I can possibly be, and I felt bad that I called him Jeffrey, and then later I was like, what are you talking about? It's on your Instagram profile.
Yeah, you got to give him some feedback on that, so because in the fashion world, you know, details matter. Just tell him details matter in fashion. So,
100%.
All right. Hey, welcome back to the state of Oregon. We'll look forward to having you back on the show on Monday, John, and football season's here. Thanks for making time for us.
Yeah, we're going to go hard with Oregon State, Washington State on Monday. We got a lot more to unpack from Oregon and Washington and the Big Ten, and we'll download on the Olympics, as you are on today's show as well.
Oh, it's going to be great. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
There he is, John Cajano. He'll be back in the chair Monday, hosting the radio show. Really great stuff. We'll have that interview podcasted here in a little bit as well. That's John Cazzano here. Judah Newby with you, Baldface Truth, BFT Radio Network. A lot to unpack from that. And, yeah, we'll talk a little bit more Olympics as we've been throughout the show as well. Here on the Baldface Truth.